Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
You're listening to HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Veryl Dana LLP. I'm Tani Alvarez, and today our guest is Robin Goodwin, the Chief Executive Officer of the Montalvo Corporation. Welcome, Robin.
Good morning, Tani. It's a pleasure to be here.
Robin, thank you so much for being here. Can you give our audience a little bit of a background about what the Montalvo Corporation does?
Yeah, so Montalvo has been in existence for over 70 years. It started in Hackensack, New Jersey, and it was one of those stories where it was a family that vacationed in Maine, wanted to ultimately raise their family in Maine, not northern New Jersey, came to Maine in the early 70s and has been here ever since. It's a second generation and 72 years. What we do, we're still small. We're small, but we're global. We like to say we fight above our weight. We do precision automation equipment for any industry that involves a physical movement of material. So people tend to think of paper, which is what we grew up on, but it is paper, plastic, corrugated, rubber, metal, carbon fiber, anything that starts as a sort of raw material and gets converted into some type of a product. We don't make the products. We tend to say we make the products people use every day better, but we don't make them. We make the equipment that allows the machines to run faster and with better quality.
I love it. And I also love, nothing against northern New Jersey for our listeners down there, but I also love the movement up to Maine generally. Did the paper aspect of kind of the beginning of the organization lead to the Maine location, or was it purely kind of, I love to say it's all about the lifestyle and what we have to offer here in the state, but was some of it just being closer to maybe some organizations or corporations who were in need of the service at that point in time?
I think that was a small piece of it. I do think it was more a personal decision for Mr. Montalvo Sr. What he had done was he used to be an independent sales rep for other products. He invented a brake, a mechanical brake used in machinery that he tried to get his other principals to sell. No one was interested, and he said, well, okay, I'm going to go into manufacturing. I'll make it myself. And Maine offered what he thought was a lower cost structure than manufacturing in northern New Jersey. He actually had his office in Manhattan at the time.
So I bet the rent was a lot cheaper.
Very expensive to manufacture there. And then the personal side of it with his family, and certainly with paper being at that time the dominant industry, there was that attraction to Maine.
Now, when we talk about industries, I mean, you mentioned that you're making products better. Is there an industry that you don't support from a manufacturing standpoint?
I'd be hard-pressed to find one. We're right now spread across, I would say, 15 to 20 industries. So virtually anything that has some type of a role. If it involves injection molding, we don't. There's no need for the products we do. But I think people would be surprised at how many products that they buy start out on some type of a roll, and including things that are going to their automobiles or Boeings and Airbuses or basic food products, the packaging that goes into that. So none that jump out. We don't do, much in the way with glass, although we are looking at fiberglass. So most of them we touch, and that's one of our strengths is diversity.
So from cereal boxes to airplanes.
Yep, that's exactly right.
That's super great. Now, tell me about your role at Montalvo. So you're the CEO, which I think is a pretty big job, which I'm guessing you have your hands in a lot of different aspects of the organization. But tell me what a day looks like for you.
There's no typical day, which makes this the most fun job I've had maybe in my entire career. The Montalvos didn't have a third generation coming forward. Their children were off into other things, some very exciting things. They wanted to step back, and through a mutual acquaintance on the board, introduced me to them in 2012. It's been a great move for me, I think a great move for them and the company. There's no typical day. I think the early years, I really spent more of my time in the field with customers, getting to understand the customers and the products and the applications and how we can better serve them. As time progressed, I've spent more time really with the organization and the people we have, particularly our R&D, developing new products, and our operations, how to become more efficient. And we also have a team in China in three different locations. It's a small team of six, a small but a powerful team. And we have a small team in Europe, Germany, and Denmark. What I've found over time is I'm spending more time in Europe and in Asia with those teams, getting us further to driving growth, and less time here in North America because of the fact that our team is established and producing very effectively. So a typical day could be one day meeting with our board of directors, the next day out on our production floor helping one of our employees, move a piece of equipment, to meeting with the employees, which we do. You know, we have a weekly meeting every Tuesday, and usually I'm the one that buys the food we have. Food always works. If the topic you have bombs, you've got food.
So. I mean, you want to have a meeting that people show up to. Offering food and having food present, I think, is the best way to entice everyone to attend, and at least to stay awake until the food has been digested.
It's the universal language.
It so. Most definitely is. So is any of your manufacturing then occurring in China or in Germany, or most of it is it mostly occurring here in Maine? And actually, can you tell our listeners where in Maine you guys are operating out of?
Yeah, so we're in Gorham, in the industrial park, just off from Route 25 Main Street. I would say we do the vast majority of it in either at our own facility or with local subcontractors. Probably 60-70% ourselves, 20-30% local contractors. We do maybe 5-10% in China, and it tends to be the very heavy mechanical items that are bulky, and it's expensive to ship overseas. So they do a small amount, and what they do is for their local market only. Everything we do is an export to them. We import very little back.
Okay, so it's really a cost of shipping that it just makes it much easier
logistics,
to produce.
It's a supply chain thing, okay. Yeah. Yep.
And then your team in Germany and Denmark, is that a sales force?
Sales and service. Okay. So we have two people in Germany, one direct sales, one technical field salesperson. We have two in Denmark, same thing, one more focused on sales, the other more on the technical field side.
Now, when did the company's 72 years old, approximately? I don't want later for someone to be like, they're 73 now, Tony. but approximately, when did the international move happen, having employees and having teams overseas? Because I think for a lot of organizations, that's a big step and a necessary step in order for them to increase their market share and to touch, you know, different areas, or sometimes it's simply not a planned move. It's mm-hmm. by necessity that they have a new client. The new client is going to need them to have a sales force kind of in this other market. How did that international market force kind of occur with you guys?
So it varies between Europe and China quite differently. And a credit to Ed Montalvo and his sister Midge Denham to recognize that. Before, a lot of companies did, the importance of growth tied to international trade. And Europe started, it's well before my time, but I would say about 25 years ago, we actually had at that time a large-scale manufacturing operation in Denmark. That ultimately, when the recession hit in 2008-2009, had to make the decision to close that. We simply didn't have enough scale between there and here in Maine to have both, and so we had to close that down. It was a tough transition, and we've had to reassure our customers over the past 10 years we are committed to Europe, even if we're not manufacturing here. And slowly but surely, we've rebuilt that confidence. In fact, they are our single biggest driver of growth in 2019. We're having an outstanding year in Europe at a year where our competitors are down. So it's taken some time. But the presence has been there for a long, long time, particularly Denmark.
Now, by having that kind of location overseas in Europe, I mean, not only then are you worried about or looking at your competitors here in the United States, but on a much grander basis, and also then concerned about different changes in import and export laws and all of that stuff. Now, is that on your plate? Do you have a team member who is assisting you and keeping track of regulations and whether or not what your costs are going to look like next year as a result of planned legislation? Or is, as a smaller, but a family-owned business, how's that work with you guys?
So it's our financial controller and our operations manager and myself really review those frequently, particularly in the current environment where they're fluid, I guess I would say. Both of those individuals actually worked with me at Fairchild Semiconductor, so they had good international experience when they joined me at Montalvo. So we monitor it very closely. We also work very closely with the Maine International Trade Center that keeps us abreast of any developments going on, sometimes before they even happen. So, that is a current topic, which we're holding our own. China is the bigger challenge right now, and we're working through the implications of that because China has actually been our fastest growth the last 3 years. It has slowed this year, and in part because of that. So in China, we're newer. We started there 10 years ago. A very wise move. I think this is something I've been able to help the Montalvos with because in my previous life, I spent so much time in China running their factories. We've rebuilt that team, and it is a very strong team. So even in the face of tariffs, we're navigating through it okay. We hope it's not a further escalation, and in fact, maybe a de-escalation here over the next 6 to 12 months.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
Now, you've mentioned a couple of times your previous life, kind of the things that you've done before you took on this role at Montalvo. You mentioned Fairchild. What's your trajectory to get to this place and this role? And you've been now with Montalvo for 11 years?
Seven years.
7 years. Okay, yep. 7 years. What were you doing beforehand?
So it's I'm a native Mainer, but I don't know if I lost that status when I lived in Massachusetts for 7 years. But
no, I think if you're born in Maine, you get to be a native Mainer, even if you boomerang back.
So I went to school at Northeastern and then stayed with digital equipment, which was everywhere in Massachusetts at the time. Younger listeners may not even know who they were, but they were a great and huge company at the time. Decided after 7 years there that it was time to come back to Maine, very similar to the Montalvos. And my career started in finance. My first 10 years were in finance. As I came back with digital in Maine, I got more and more involved in the operational side of things. I went and got my APIC certification. I got very intrigued with that. And I got into the operational side of things, running, you know, things like manufacturing and materials and purchasing. When digital, ultimately the demise of digital started through the 90s, our facility was sold to a contract manufacturer from Alabama. It wasn't a good fit for me. It was a perfect time to join what at the time was National Semiconductor, which then became Fairchild Semiconductor. and it was there for 18 years. I started again in finance, but operations pulled me back in very quickly, and most of my career there was in operations. First in the planning and logistics and purchasing, and then ultimately running global operations. So that was through 2012. There were changes going on there at the time that felt like it was the right time for me to move on. Part of it was traveling extensively. Living on planes was really getting old.
Understandable.
Didn't know what I wanted to do, but it just I took some time off. I just stepped away. Knew some folks, particularly the president at Thomas College, Larry LaChance, always wanted to teach. Lo and behold, I was teaching within a few weeks. It was the most terrified I'd ever been in front of a group.
I actually, you know what? I want to stop us there. I want to take a break, and I want to jump back into that because I want to talk more about that.
Okay.
So you're listening to HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back to hear more from Robin Goodwin, the CEO at the Montalva Corporation.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobs in ME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs in ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsinme.com. That's jobsinme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
We're back, and you're listening to HR Power Hour, and our guest today is Robin Goodwin, the CEO of the Montalva Corporation. I'm Tawny Alvarez, and we are just talking about Robin's progression into his role as CEO at Montalvo. And where we stopped was when he began speaking about Lori LaChance at Thomas College. So I'd like to jump back in and to hear a little bit more about, it sounds like, some teaching engagement up there at Thomas.
Yeah, so for the first time in my career, I really had an opportunity to think, what do I want to do? I'm in my early 50s, but my career had moved and it worked well, but I had time to take a breath. And I had always wanted to teach. I knew Lori from her days at Maine Development Foundation and said, just called her on a whim, and it was December. And she said, well, actually, yeah, I want you to come up and talk to Jim Libby and the dean of the academic side. And within a week, I was signed up to teach an undergrad economics course. And then a couple days later, they said, actually, how about an MBA course in strategic planning? And I said, you do know I've never taught before. I think they were in a bind.
They're throwing you in head first into it.
But it was some of the most fun I've ever had. It was also, as I said, some of the most terrifying, and my wife would ask me, why are you so nervous speaking in front of 15 or 20 freshmen or grad students, whatever? And I said, what if they think I'm terrible? And what if I am? And, you know, I said, I've spoken in front of, you know, factories of 2,000 people and down on Wall Street. And I said, I was the most nervous I've ever been.
That's hilarious.
Because it was out of my comfort zone. It also turned out to be some of the most fun I ever had. I started to do some other work. Lori's doing some great things, continues to be up at Thomas. Offered me, a really good opportunity on the strategic side of things, developing programs, and I could teach as much or as little as I wanted. It was perfect. It was just what I wanted.
I love that about Thomas, honestly, as an individual with a business degree, and actually a business degree from Thomas College. I love the fact that so much of the faculty has real-world experience.
She is very big on that.
Yeah, there's the academic side of everything, which is really important, and the theoretical discussion. But I think one of the things that we're seeing more and more in the real world is a number of students and young adults who are entering the workforce who lack the ability to perform job skills and functions because their education to that point has been so academically based and not real world or project based. And I think one of the really cool things about what you've just described, and I think what Thomas is doing, is making sure that a graduate is coming out understanding what they can expect from the real world. And in part, that is because of the professors that they are bringing in who are able to offer that guidance and advice as to what it's really going to look like when they enter the job market.
And with the MBA strategic planning class, one of the really the main project that I did was pairing students up with companies to work on strategic plans. So, and I called in some favors from, not only my companies, but others, you know, Hudamaki, Johnny Selected Seeds, companies particularly trying to get into the Waterville area, Alcom, on allowing the students to come in and work with them to actually see not what a strategic plan was just in a textbook, but actually doing one and how difficult it is and what the factors are.
Robin Goodwin, CEO of the Montalvo Corporation, is who we're talking to today. And earlier he mentioned the fact that the market is international and he's got employees in China and in Denmark. And when we're talking about a strategic plan, we're not looking at something that is just Maine-based or the United States-based, but we're trying to take into account all these changes and evolutions of laws, of regulations, of the product line and the need as we're creating that strategic plan.
Yeah. Yep. So it was seemed to be that was the path I was on through one of the board members at Montalvo, who was really kind of my mentor at Digital Equipment, said, you ought to talk to the Montalvos and just kind of, you know, I said, family-owned business, I'm the outsider. We talked and we talked and we talked for probably 6 months as I got close to, you know, taking something in a permanent position at Thomas. The more I learned of the challenge, and the more, and what I found was it was going to be a bigger challenge. Probably it was a safer path, but I've always been intrigued by the bigger challenge. And at the end, manufacturing is in my blood, and I thought, it was a 20% probability I would go to Montalvo, and it started to become the 80%, and finally it came to fruition. And I still work with Thomas College on some things, but it was the pull to get back, and there was a little bit of a pull that, despite all the, you know, different things and large organizations I'd had and big companies, I had never had the opportunity to run the whole thing. And it felt like this was my shot. And I'd be fine if I didn't, but it would always feel like I'd have a void. I'd have a void, and I'd be thinking, what if? Knowing I could fail, but not knowing if I didn't try. And so I ended up at Montalvo after, as I said, 6 or 7 months of talking. And I won't say every day I didn't came in and it was just a smooth linear upward progression. There were days of doubts.
If you said that it was a smooth linear uphill progression, I'd know you're lying.
I'd be lying. There were times of doubt, but in hindsight and to where we're at now, it is perhaps the most rewarding thing in my career.
So let's talk a little bit about entry into a family-owned business. You mentioned earlier the fact that came into a second-generation company that the third generation wasn't, was doing their forging their own path is the way I like to say it when dealing with family-owned businesses. I work with a lot of clients who are family-owned businesses, and I find that family-owned businesses present their own set of challenges that is different from non-family-owned businesses. coming in as the outsider, were you faced with kind of an evolution of moving from that family-owned business mindset into something that was different, or an evolution of the company just generally, but simultaneously weaving in that background of being family-owned? Did you find that to be a challenge?
It was, although for folks I've talked with in similar circumstances, I think at the end I would say I probably had it as good as it could be. One is I had, again, the person I had gone back with 25 years, and he said, we're an active board. We're not just an advisory board. The Montavos, you know, listen closely to us. We have fiduciary responsibility, so we will play a big role in it. And I have a tremendous amount of respect for this individual. Harry Frazier, who had done similar things with Thomas Mosier Cabinet Makers, and then Johnny's Select Seeds, where he took them all the way through an ESOP. And I thought, well, that's as good of advice as I could get from a person who's done it. And I, again, have a lot of respect for him, so I said I'll try it. The other thing is I spent a lot of time with Ed Montavo and Midge Denham, the brother and sister in that second generation. And we really focused on their values. And what I started to realize is, and it had to be, for me it was critical, is to have alignment on values. The companies I had left was when the values had changed, and they, or maybe mine had changed, I don't know, but there was misalignment. And I said, I can't work. I need to be aligned to the company that I'm a part of to believe in it. And I found we had very, very good synergy, whether it be customer service, how we treat and manage and develop employees. I looked at their mission. I looked at their value set. And I said, I think this can work. And I will say, in terms of support, even when I moved in directions that I don't think they entirely agreed with, and maybe had objections raised by others, even some outside the company, they backed me every single time. And it got tested very early on, because I think people who had worked with the Montavos for many years believed they would not let me make changes that might not be favorable to them. And they found out they were wrong. I really couldn't ask for better support from owners. I just couldn't. They're fantastic people.
I think that's a really great point that is undervalued or not talked about enough. And that's the point that making sure that when we talk about fit, anyone entering into an organization, that foundationally there is an understanding between both parties, the employer and the employee, even at the top, even at this level, that you have the same outlook on how the product or service is going to come to market. And that might be that you have to take a couple steps back before you can move forward. And if you're misaligned in that concept or mindset as to what the strategy or concepts are moving forward, I think you're going to find both parties are just hitting their heads against the wall so often that there is either going to be a breakdown of communications, a breakdown of the respect between the parties. And I think it's great that you spent 6 months getting to know the team, getting to know the company and understanding, is this going to be the right fit for me? Granted, there's going to be ups and downs no matter what, but this is truly what you're looking for.
Yeah, I think one of the things that the Montavos did, which I think was a very wise move, was they had me come in and they said, I took a week when I was on vacation. It was a school vacation, so I wasn't teaching. And they said, why don't you come in and spend 2-3 days, whatever you want, in the office you'll be in, and sign an NDA. You'll have access to everything, every person, reports, financials, and be sort of like you're in the role, which was a very clever move. Because so I did, and I would talk to people, or I'd go out on the floor. I had free access to everything, and it allowed me to feel like this is what it is, not just an interview, but this is me doing the job. There was no pay. It was just a multi-day interview.
And in that moment, did you come up with ideas as to ways to create more efficiencies? And did that then drive you to say, like, oh my gosh, I could affect change here?
Yeah, that sort of swung the tide. And at the end, I said, I still don't know. I'm undecided, but I feel like I owe you something because I've taken 2 or 3 days of your time and your people. So I wrote them the equivalent of a consulting report saying, these are the strategic things that I see. These are some operational things. These are the financial challenges. And I said, whether I ever come here or not, you do this what you want. What it did was it effectively said I was already sort of putting myself in the role. That was in April, and within 6 weeks, we had an agreement, and I was starting. So, again, kudos to them. A very, very wise way to do it, and very effective. And it gave me what I needed to know to say, I've got to do this. I have to do this. I felt like if I passed, nothing against Thomas, great opportunity, I would have always been looking back going, what if? And I didn't. I didn't want to do that. So,
and it's interesting for those who aren't in the studio right now, which is everyone who's listening. The smile on Robin's face right now just shows such complete engagement. And to have a CEO who can speak about their experience entering a company, and then, you know, 7 years later, still running and operating a company, and to see the just look on his face of complete engagement, I think is so important. And it's something we spend a lot of time talking about right now, is how do you get engagement from your team, from the people who are in leadership positions, so that they don't experience burnout, so that they don't experience a sense that that they can't affect change. And in a lot of ways, yes, as a CEO, it's easier to affect change than it may be working the line. But let's talk about engagement. I can feel the engagement that you have. How do you maintain that engagement through the other people in your organization? And I know that they're engaged because I've talked to them. So share a little bit with our listeners about how you engage your employee base.
My style is maybe untraditional from other CEOs. In fact, I still don't really think of myself as a CEO. It is very participatory. In fact, I even tell people, if you just want me to tell you what to do, this might be uncomfortable for you because I'm looking for your ideas on how we shape this. Now, I have some ideas. I'm not just coming in and taking a bunch of ideas and putting it together and in a pot and mixing it up. But I believe every person has a value on ideas. And in fact, for their particular area, they have better ideas than I'm going to have. And I listen. I listen a lot. I spend a lot of time asking questions to try to understand, but to hear what people think, what do they like, what don't they like, why do they work here, what they don't like about working here. And I think over time, I think employees, there was sort of a, okay, yeah, all right, well, we'll see how long the new guy lasts. And then I think they started to realize as they saw some changes, not dramatic. I don't believe in coming in and making a big change for the sake of a change. It'd be small things, and then a few smaller things, and then they started to see some momentum coming from that. And then I think it established trust, that they trusted me, and they thought, yeah, because I think they not only questioned my staying power, is the family going to be committed to doing this? Or will they get tired of the outsider and it'll go back to the way it was? So it took about a year.
That's absolutely perfect. And it's so great to hear kind of your role in that engagement process. I'm Tani Alvarez. You're listening to HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We're talking to Robin Goodwin, the CEO of the Montalvo Corporation, and we're going to take a quick break, but we're going to be right back.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. JobsInME.com has been matching main employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on JobsInME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit JobsInME.com. That's JobsInME.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
Life's never perfect, but as realtors, we know living it in the perfect place can make a big difference.
Imagine
hiding from your screeching children in that spacious walk-in closet, watching the neighbor's dog poop on the freshly sodded grass you negotiated during closing, dropping your cell phone in the toilet of the spa-like five-piece bathroom again. So get the perfect place to house all of life's imperfections. Get Realtor. Realtors are members of the National Association of Realtors.
We're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour. Our guest today is Robin Goodwin, the CEO of the Montalvo Corporation. We just finished talking a little bit about engagement and how he, as a CEO, has engaged his workforce to show up, and not just to show up because that's what they need to do, but to present and to move the company forward. I always find it interesting that when we're talking about the style of leadership, that we talk about mentoring and, in more cases recently, sponsorship. And I really like the term sponsorship because I think mentoring is a less hands-on type process, but you mentioned earlier that you have had some mentors. Can you talk a little bit more about the mentors during the course of your career and how you deal with difficult situations at this point in time in your career?
So I certainly early in my career had several just excellent mentors, and it was to have it early in the career is just, I think it's huge. One was actually in Massachusetts, a woman who's actually gone on to some just phenomenal things. She speaks around the world now on lean and manufacturing and lean administration, and just outstanding. And she was really the catalyst of that got me started out of college. And then after I moved back to Maine, I had a couple of individuals when I was with Digital in Augusta, Harry Frazier, who I mentioned, and John Weaver, who I would say I learned as much from. I don't think my style necessarily is the same as theirs, but I think it probably looks similar. I've had others over time, but that foundation really came from me in my first roughly 10 to 12 years of my career. I had some other good ones from then. I also had, I'll say, as many bad ones as I did good ones, as we all do. Even there, I think I learned from the ones that I saw as ineffective, and it helped to reinforce what I believe was right. And I sort of took it as, what are the things that work for me? Take as much of that as I can. And then what are the things that really demotivate me for others? And it's very simplistic, but thinking people are people. And at the end of the day, most of us want the same thing. So the ones that I would walk through a wall for, I want to do their kind of things. The ones that I want to walk out the door on, I'm going to stay away from their practices. And hopefully if I get that right combination, I've got something that works for people who want to work on my team.
I adore that you mentioned that and that you even brought it up, because I think one of the things that we find right now is that individuals either refuse to or don't want to talk about failure, that they look at failure or a relationship that didn't turn out the way they expected as being a waste of time without focusing on the positive attributes of the fact that that relationship didn't work, that you were able to take away from that experience the things you didn't want to do from a leadership standpoint, the things that you found ineffective or inefficient, or maybe even the things that worked for that individual and their leadership style, but that isn't going to work for you.
Right.
based off of personality type, based off of generational divide, all of those different aspects, being able to identify those things are so important. And I think that when we focus so much on winning, on success, on all those ideas, that we de-emphasize the importance of failure. Because if we're not failing or experiencing events or circumstances that don't live up to our expectation, I don't think we're reaching far enough and that we're pushing ourselves to accomplish more than what we have right now.
I completely agree. I think, and I really encourage people, is take risks. If you've never failed, you've either had a very blessed career or you probably haven't pushed yourself. And when you do fail, you will get back up. But the most important thing is you have to learn from it. What were the reasons why? What were the factors maybe you contributed to it? And don't repeat it. But there's value in that. There's a lot of value in that. It doesn't feel it at the time, and it hurts. But it strengthens you for the long run.
And I think over the course of your career with Hope, when you make changes, when you pivot, in pivoting, you're going to have a better idea of what works for you, either from a professional standpoint, from a work-life balance perspective. And something that we talked about earlier would be from an ethical or from a what are you looking for? What are your values? And that value-driven perspective. One of the things that you mentioned while we were talking about kind of all of this and mentors is about style. And earlier we talked about the expanded workforce, having employees in China, having employees in Denmark and Germany. What is one of the aspects of having that international workforce that has come to top of mind from a style perspective? I presume that the management style that you use with your United States or North America workforce is in some ways a little different from the style that you use when communicating in China or even when you're working with your German workforce.
So there are differences. They're not as dramatic, I think. Sometimes people think they've got to almost completely reinvent themselves and be a new person. And I think that's difficult to do. In fact, you may come across as sort of a phony. And again, at the end of the day, I believe people are people, even when there's cultural differences. Having said that, there are important cultural differences that you need to understand. Asia and China, for me, particularly when I joined Montavo, was much easier. I'd spent so much time. I probably 50, 60, 70 trips. I lost track of how many trips to China and throughout Asia. And so I got to know the people there very well. There are some cultural things that you absolutely need to understand and respect. And if you do that, what you'll quickly find, I think, sometimes people have a perception of, oh, in China, it's very difficult, are they ethical, they steal intellectual property, and they do all those kinds of things. And we had, some of that even in our early days. The team we have now largely came from my semiconductor world. We rebuilt the team. They are the hardest working, most ethical, most driven team, and they partner with us extremely well. So you can find good and bad people in any culture. They're just rock stars. And you have to adapt a little bit. There are differences. But at the end, their values are largely shared. Europe, also a little bit different. In some ways, I found Europe can be more different than the U.S. than China can, particularly when it comes to work schedules and work weeks. There are things both different culturally and legally, and you need to adapt to those. But even there, you find the common ground. What I tried to do is say, these are the things, obviously, we'll moderate. But there are some things that I said, these are things that are non-negotiable. And particularly our core values is, I said, those are not negotiable. If you don't buy into the core values, then you're in the wrong place, maybe.
No, so. I think that those are all really good and important things. And I think it's important to note that the best way to be successful and to have people follow you is authenticity. And we talk about authenticity a lot, and people can tell when you're being inauthentic. And nobody wants to lead, or no one wants to follow a leader who's inauthentic, because it's too difficult to figure out when either their authentic self is going to come out or when the style is going to change or whether or not the leader is going to turn on or off, whatever it is that they're trying to sell or get people to accomplish. I'm Tawny Alvarez. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBRadio.com. We're going to take a quick break and return to talk to Robin Goodwin, the CEO of Montalvo Corporation.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobs in ME.com has been matching main employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their QuickPost product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs in ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsinme.com. That's jobsinme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
We're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, and our guest today is Robin Goodwin, the CEO of the Montalvo Corporation. We've talked a lot about international workforce, the product that Montalvo creates, manufacturing generally. I think that the big elephant in the room right now, however, is the fact that we are talking about manufacturing. And we're in an environment right now where I think that there is a lack of emphasis in our culture placed on the importance of jobs in manufacturing generally, or a perception that all of these jobs have been moved overseas and there's no need to have anyone who is skilled in the manufacturing arena. Talk to me a little bit about how Montalvo is dealing with, I'm going to just put it right out there, a lack of skilled workforce in this area, and your role with both state and national organizations in attempting to remedy this issue.
Yeah, so absolutely. It's workforce development is in vogue everywhere in the state and the country. And it is a huge, huge issue for small companies, big companies. It doesn't really matter. And it is predominantly, I think Maine's issue is even exacerbated just by the age distribution. The demographics are, with, as everybody knows, we're the oldest state in the country that continues to move in that direction. The risk of young people feeling they've got to move away to get good jobs. So I think for me, as I said, I'm a manufacturing guy, have been most of my career, and I think people in the state and the country still may not recognize the value that manufacturing brings. U.S. is still the number one manufacturer in the world. People tend to think it's all China. The U.S. manufactures more than any country in the world, and will continue to do so. It's just manufacturing has changed. It's changed, I think, for the better. So a lot of the things that are the more repeated tasks have been automated. And sometimes people see that as a threat. I see it as, A, it's a necessity to compete. But B, is it gives you a chance to have a better and more interesting job. So people think machine shops, and they tend to think dirty, grimy, oily, dusty. And quite frankly, it's not the case for the most part. These are very skilled positions running highly technical pieces of equipment. They require programming. It is possible to take individuals out of high school and train them, and we do some of that. But we, in particular, we'll look for people that could have at least a two-year degree through like a Central Maine Community College. We emphasize a lot internships. We've had interns in engineering, operations, marketing. We have one in finance now from USM. We've seen that as a good opportunity to get students to be aware of what we're doing as a company, and potentially, and in several cases, they become our employees when they graduate. The other thing I think is through the Manufacturers Association is our what we call a Manufacturers Career Connection. We've had in the last 5 years over 10,000 students, high school and middle school, trying to also get down into that middle school, into a factory, at least one factory in the state of Maine, over 10,000 students. And it's to get them to see what we do as manufacturers and maybe change that perception that it's the, you know, old, dirty, grimy, I punch in, I punch out. Manufacturing jobs tend to pay more, and there tends to be more upward opportunity. Some of our people who start as operators on the floor have that lead into technicians' positions, and we do, and we have an extensive education program where we have people going for everything from their MBAs to their associate's degrees to just getting a certificate in some type of a machining type of thing. So all paid by Montalvo.
I think that that aspect of career development and paying for the education and assisting in that process is so important to that engagement discussion that we had earlier, and helping people to understand that this is skilled work, and it's skilled work that you can evolve and grow with the company and help us create more efficiencies generally. Thank you so much, Robin, for coming in and talking to me about both your role at Montalvo and the work that you guys are doing generally. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Tawny. I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you to our listeners. You've been listening to HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. Tune in next week.
And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by VeralDana.com.
This is Liz Johnston from VeralDana. Seasonal hires are a great way to ensure that your organization is adequately staffed for a busy season, but there are a few things you should keep in mind to make sure that things run smoothly. First, don't skimp on training. Seasonal hires should be trained for their specific positions, as well as on your company's anti-harassment and discrimination policies, injury reporting procedures, and available benefits, like whether they are eligible for paid time off. Next, while you're probably familiar with the employment rules and regulations that apply to your regular or full-time staff, you should take note of what laws might apply to your seasonal hires. For example, federal and state overtime rules will generally apply for non-exempt hires, but FLMA policies probably won't take effect for seasonal workers if they don't meet the minimum hours required to qualify for coverage. There are also additional wage and hour laws to be aware of when it comes to employing minors. For example, the FLSA provides that 14 and 15-year-olds may not work before 7 a.m. or after 7 p.m., except for between June 1st and Labor Day. State laws can provide additional and sometimes more restrictive guidelines. If you have questions about what else you should consider when it comes to hiring seasonal employees, contact me or another member of VeralDana's Labor and Employment Group.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VeralDana.com. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.